his bride-to-be with their twisting of time, he never could remember that some Varagon missiles were slower than sound. Basiritz couldn't understand how sound could have a speed, like his squadmates claimed even seeing did. But the crack of his weapon reached the Rixwoman before the killing sphere of ferrocarbon, and with Basiritz-like speed she ducked. The ball shot shattered three layers of ornamental pleasure garden wall but missed its target. And now the Rixwoman knew where Basiritz was. The swarm of seeking bullets proved that, though she herself had disappeared. All manner of shit was about to come his way. Fast shit, maybe faster than Basiritz. Basiritz decided to swallow his pride and call on help from the ship above. With his right hand, he pulled a black disc from his shoulder holster. Yanking a red plastic tab from the top, Basiritz waited for the few seconds it took the disc to confirm that it had, in fact, awoken. That red light meant that there was a man in it now, a wee man who you couldn't see. Basiritz stood and took the stance of one skipping a flat stone across water and hurled the disc down the long hallway. It glanced once against the marble floor, making the sharp sound of a hammer on stone, then lofted up like a leaf caught by a sudden wind. Pilot. Master Pilot Joachim Marx assumed control of the Y-1 General Tactical Floater as easily as slipping on an undershirt. Whatever grunt had thrown the floater had imparted a good steady spin, and the small craft's fan drive accelerated without turbulence. Marx looked out across the terrain materializing in synesthesia, adjusting to the much larger scale of the floater, almost 100 times the size of an intelligencer, and the new perspective. He preferred flying these fast small craft with an inverted viewpoint, in which the floor of the palace was a ceiling over his head, the legs of humans hanging from it like giant stalactites. The enemy target was a sharp-eared Rix commando, so the floater was seen with only passive sensors and its highest frequency echolocation. The view was blurry, but the long, featureless hallways offered few obstacles. The master pilot took his craft up to just a few centimeters from the floor, brought it to a halt behind the cover of an ornamental column. According to battle data compiled by the Lynx Insertion AI, the nearest Rix commando was roughly 20 meters ahead. A hail of audio came from the canopy speakers. Blaster fire! The Rix was on the move, closing on the Marine who had tossed the floater. She had the Marine's position, was moving in for the kill. Firefight debris began to fill the air. The brittle glass and stone of the palace demanded the crudest sort of tactics. Bludgeon your enemies with firepower, raining projectiles on them to cover any advance. Rix blasters were particularly well suited for this. It was not the best environment for floaters. Marx took his craft farther away from the Marine, escaping the maelstrom of flying glass and dust, circling around to take a position behind the advancing Rix. At least in this cacophony, the commando wouldn't hear the soft whine of the floater's fan. Marx brought his active sensors online and decided to go in close. There were several ways to kill with a floater. Paint the target with a laser and have a Marine launch a cigarette-sized guided missile. Or deploy the floater's skirt of poison spurs and ram the enemy. Or simply spot for the Marine from some safe vantage, whispering in the soldier's ear. But Marx heard his Marine's ragged breathing, a panicked sound as the man ran from his pursuer and realized there wasn't time for any but the direct approach. He brought the floater up to ramming speed. Sweeping around a corner, Marx's craft emerged from the palace into a dense sculpture garden, the way blocked by the splayed shapes of birds in flight, wind-blown reeds and flowering trees, all rendered in wire-thin metal. Marx found himself within a few meters of the Rix, the purr of her servo muscles just audible through the din of blaster fire. But she was moving through the sculptures at inhuman Rix speed, dodging and rolling among the razor-sharp sculptures. It was possible she had detected his floater. She had moved into very inhospitable terrain for Marx. If the floater collided with one of these sculptures, its fan drive would be knocked out of alignment, the craft instantly useless. With the light-speed delay of remote control, this garden was a nightmare to fly through. Or for the true master pilot, a challenge, Marx thought with a smile. He closed in, prepping the poison spurs of the ram skirt with a harsh vocal command. Private. Basiritz was bleeding. The Rixwoman had hounded him into the corner of two long hallways bounded by supporting walls, one of the few hypercarbon structures in the palace. His Varagon couldn't blast through them. Basiritz was trapped here, exposed and wounded. The Rixwoman's incessant fire had brought down a hail of fragments on him, a stone-hard rain. One random sliver had cut through a thin joint in his armor, tearing into his leg just behind the knee plate. Basiritz's helmet visor was scratched and webbed. He could barely see, but he dared not take it off. and Astra and Saman were dead. They had trusted Basiritz's kill shot too much and had exposed themselves. For the moment, though, the Rixwoman seemed to have paused in her relentless pursuit. Maybe she was savoring the kill, or possibly the wee man in the disc was troubling her. Perhaps there was time to escape. But the two wide hallways stretched for a few hundred meters without cover, and Basiritz could hear the Rixwoman still moving through the garden of crazy shapes. He felt hunted, and thought of the tigers that sometimes took people outside his village. Up! His mind screamed. Climb a tree! He searched the smooth hypercarbon walls for handholds. Basiritz's sharp eyes spotted a sequence of slots in the hypercarbon that led up to the top of the wall. Probably some sort of catch so that the walls could be repositioned. Basiritz dropped his Verigun, most of its ammo was expended anyway, and drew from his boots the pair of small hypercarbon knives his mother had given him just before the time thief had taken her. He thrust one knife into a slot. Its thin blade fit perfectly. He pulled himself up. The hypercarbon blade didn't bend, of course, though supporting his entire weight with a grip on its tiny handle made his fingers scream. He ignored the pain and began to climb. Pilot. Marx pursued the thudding boots of the Rix Commando through the sharp twists and turns of the garden, his knuckles white on the control surface. The floater could barely keep up with this woman machine. She definitely knew a small craft was pursuing her. She had twice turned to fire blindly behind, her weapon set to a wide shotgun blast that forced Marx to screeching halts under cover of the metal sculptures. But now he was gaining. The Rixwoman had fallen once, slipping on a sliver of glass from some earlier stage of the firefight, and she'd skidded into glancing contact with the sharp extremities of a statue representing a flock of birds. Now she left drops of thin Rix blood behind her on the marble floor and ran with a noticeable limp. Marx urged his craft through the blur of obstacles, knowing he could reach her in the next few seconds. Suddenly the sculptures parted, and Hunter and Quarry burst from the garden. Realizing that the open terrain was now against her, the commando spun on one unsteady heel to fire back at Marx's craft. He flipped the craft over and it leapt up from the floor as her blaster cratered the marble beneath him. The floater's ram spurs extended to full. He hurtled toward her helmeted face. Marx fought to get the craft down, knowing it would bounce off her visor. He had to hit the vulnerable areas of hands or the joints of her armor, but the craft was thrown crazily forward by the concussion wave of the blaster explosion. It was not his piloting skill, but the woman's own reflexes that doomed her. With the disc flying directly at her face, she reached up with one hand to ward off the impact, an instinctive gesture that even 3,000 years of Rix engineering had not completely removed. The spurs cut into her palm, thinly gloved to allow a full range of motion, and injected their poison. The floater rebounded from the impact with flesh. It was whining unhealthily now, the delicate lifter fan mechanism a few crucial millimeters out of alignment. But the job was done. Marx took control of the suddenly unwieldy craft and climbed to a safe height to watch his adversary die. But she still stood, shaking as the poison nanos spread through the biological and mechanical pathways of her body. She took a few more steps from the garden, looking frantically about. She spotted something. Marx cursed all things Rix. She should have dropped like a stone. But in the decades since the last incursion, the Rix immune system must have evolved sufficiently to give her another few moments of life. And she had sighted an Imperial Marine. The man's back was to her, as he somehow pulled himself up the smooth wall 20 meters away. The Rix Commando shakily raised her weapon, trying to buy one last Imperial casualty with her death. Marx thought of ramming her again, but his damaged craft only massed a few grams. The gesture would be futile. The Marine was doomed. But Marx couldn't let her shoot him in the back. He triggered the floater's collision warning alarm, and the craft expended the rest of its waning power to emit a screeching wail. Marx watched in amazement as the Marine reacted. In a single motion, the man turned and spotted the Rix, and leapt from the wall as her blaster fired, one arm flinging out in a gesture of defiance against her. The round exploded against the hypercarbon, the shockwave hurling the Marine a dozen meters through the air to crash against the stone floor, his armor cracking it like a hammer. With unexpected grace, the man rolled to his feet, facing his opponent. But the Rix was dead. She spun to the ground. At first, Marx thought the poison had finally taken her, but then he spotted the blood gushing from her throat. From the soft armor seam there, the handle of a knife, Marx marveled, protruded. The Marine had thrown it as he fell. Master Pilot Marx whistled as his craft began to fall, energy expended. Finally, he had met an unaugmented human whose reflexes matched his own. Perhaps were even superior. He patched himself through to the Marine's helmet. Nice throw, soldier. Through the floater's fading vision, he saw the Marine jog toward the Ricks and pull the knife from her throat. The man cleaned it carefully with a small rag he pulled from one boot and tipped his visor at the floater as it wafted toward the ground. Thanks, wee man, the Marine answered in a rough, outworld accent. Wee man? Marks wondered. But there wasn't time to ask. Another Y-1 general tactical floater had just been activated. One last Ricks woman remained alive. Marx's talents were needed elsewhere. Initiate Barris was trapped in darkness. His brain rang like a persistent alarm that no one has bothered to turn off. One side of his face seemed paralyzed, numb. He had realized from the first moment of the drop that something was wrong. The acceleration gel hadn't had time to completely fill the capsule. When the terrific jolt of launch came, his helmet was partly exposed. A few seconds into the frantic, thunderous journey, the dropship had whipped around, triggering an explosion in his head. That's when the ringing in his brain had started. Now the vehicle was grounded. A few minutes had passed, he dizzily suspected, but the automatic egress sequence had failed. He stood shoulder deep in the mud of the gel, which was slowly leaking out of some rupture in the damaged craft. The gel supported his battered body, warm, soft, and womb-like, but Initiate Barris's training compelled him to escape the dropship. The Emperor's secret must be protected. He tried to shoot open the door, but the Varigun failed to work. Was the gel jamming it? He pulled the weapon up out of the sucking mud. Of course, he realized the barrel was sealed against the impact gel that filled the vehicle, and a safety mechanism had prevented its firing. He pulled the seal, the sucking pop, faint in his ruptured hearing. In the lightless capsule, Barris was unsure what setting the Varigun defaulted to. The Marine sergeant on board the Lynx had warned him not to use fragmentation grenades at short range, which certainly seemed a sensible suggestion. Barris swallowed, imagining shrapnel bouncing around in the coffin-sized payload's space. But his conditioning was insistent. It would not brook further delay. Barris gritted his teeth, pointed the Varigun at the dropship door, and fired. A high scream like the howl of fresh hardwood cut on a rotary saw filled his ears. A bright arc appeared, the light from outside stabbing in through the perforating metal. Then, in a sudden rush, he was tumbling outward, the rent door bursting open under the weight of the gel. He stumbled to his feet and looked around. Something was missing, Barris dully thought for a moment. Something wrong. The world seemed halved. He looked at the gun in his hands and understood. Its barrel faded into darkness. He was blind in one eye. Barris reached up to touch his face, but the battle armor stiffened. He pulled against the resistance, thinking a joint or servo motor was damaged, but it wouldn't budge. Then a diagnostic glyph, one of many mysterious signs of light inside his visor, winked frantically. He realized what was happening. The battle armor wouldn't let him touch his face. The natural instinct to probe the wound was contraindicated. He looked for a mirror, a reflection in some metal surface, but then thought better of it. The numbness in his face was anesthetic. Who knew what awful damage he might see? And the Emperor's work needed doing. The map projected on his visor made sense after a few moments of thought. Concentrating was difficult. He was probably concussed or worse. With grim effort, Barris walked toward the council chamber, his body shaking inside the smooth gait of the body armor's servo motors. Sounds of a distant firefight pierced the ringing in his head, but he couldn't ascertain their direction. The clipped phrases of Imperial battle talk buzzed in his head, incomprehensible and strangely tinny. His hearing was damaged as well. He strode doggedly on. A series of booms, two groups of four, shook the floor. It seemed as if the Lynx were trying to bring the palace down around him. Well, at least that might get the job done if Barris couldn't. The initiate reached the doors to the council chamber. A lone Marine, anonymous in battle armor, waved to him from a kneeling position just outside. The chamber had been secured. Was he too late? Perhaps there was only one Marine here. Initiate Barris leveled his Varigun at the figure and pressed the firing stud. The weapon resisted for a moment, held in check by some sort of friendly fire governor buzzing at him with yet another alarm. But when Barris ignored it and squeezed again harder, a stream of the ripping projectile sprayed across the Marine. The barrage knocked the figure down and ejected a wave of dust and particles from the marble wall and floor. The fallen Marine was swallowed by the cloud, but Barris moved forward, spraying his weapon into the debris. Once or twice he saw a struggling limb emerge from the cloud, the black battle armor fragmenting gradually beaten to pieces by the insistent hail of projectiles. Finally, the gun whined down into silence, expended. Surely the Marine was dead. Barris switched the Varigun to another setting at random and stepped into the council chamber. Captain. Shots fired near the chamber, sir. Captain Lawrence Zai looked at his executive officer in surprise. The battle had been going well. Another of the Ricks was dead, and the sole surviving enemy commando had been hounded almost to the outer wall of the palace complex. She was clearly in retreat. Zai had just ceased the railgun bombardment. The second wave of Marines and a host of local militia had begun to secure the crumbling palace. Ricks weaponry? Sounds friendly, sir. According to the squad-level telemetry, it's Initiate Barris. His suit diagnostics look dodgy, but if they're reading true, he's just expended his projectile ammo. One casualty. Zai swore. Just what he needed. A run-amuck political ruining his rescue mission. Crash that idiot's armor, executive officer. Done, sir, Hobbs said with a subtle flick of her wrist. She must have had the order pre-configured. Zai switched his voice to the Marine Sergeant's channel. Forget the last commando, Sergeant. Secure that council chamber. Let's evacuate those hostages before anything goes wrong. Corporal. Marine Corporal Mirami Lau had just decided to lower the stasis field when the shooting outside started. The railgun bombardment had ceased, and the ceiling of the council chamber seemed stable. One Marine was stationed outside the chamber, and a few of the hostages had crept out from under the shelter of the council table. Lau had suspected the situation was secure and wanted to check in with the Lynx. But then the muted scream of Varigun fire had erupted, a cloud of firefight dust rolling in through the chamber doors. Lau listened for the thudding of Rick's blasters, but she could discern nothing through the heavy veil of the stasis field. She kept the field up, positioning herself between the Empress and the doors. Vetcher was talking to himself, a low murmur of disbelief as he probed the ultrasound wrap with instruments and his fingers. Some sort of tumor had afflicted the Empress's symbiont, apparently. What had the Ricks done to her? The sounds of the firefight ended after a few seconds. A broken figure stumbled through the dust and into the council chamber. An injured Marine in battle armor. The helmet was crushed on one side. As the figure shambled toward them, Lau could see the face through the cracked visor. She knew all the Lynx's Marines by sight, but the hideous mask was unrecognizable. The man's left eye had exploded out of its socket, and the jaw on that side was slack with anesthetic. It looked more like an insertion injury than blaster fire. The figure walked toward her, waving frantically. A few steps away, the Marine crumpled, dropping with the sudden ragdoll lifelessness of an armor crash, the dozens of servo motors that enabled Marines to carry the heavy armor failing all at once. The Marine sprawled helplessly on the floor. Lau listened. It was silent outside. Doctor, she said, how is the Empress? I'm not sure if I'm helping her or not, the doctor answered. Her symbiont is unique. I need diagnostics from space side before I can treat her. All right. Admiral? The Admiral nodded. Lau lowered the field, squinting for the second it took her visor to compensate for relatively bright light of the chamber. With her very gun aimed at the chamber door, she reached out and dragged the wounded Marine inside the field perimeter. If the firelight started again, the man might as well be protected. The Marine rolled onto his back. Who was he? Lau wondered. Even with his ruined face, she should be able to recognize him. She knew every Marine aboard the Lynx. The man's rank insignia was missing. More Marines appeared at the door. They were moving low, battle-weary. Tactical orders were still flying in secondary hearing. One more Rick's commando remained. The wounded Marine attempted to speak, and a mouthful of oxy compound emerged from his lips. Rick's. Here, he gurgled. Lau's fingers shot for the generator's controls again, raised the stasis field. Damn, the doctor swore. I lost the connection. I need Lynx's medical AI. Sorry, doctor, she said, but the situation is not secure. Lau looked back at the wounded Marine to offer assistance. He was crawling toward the dead Rick's commando, dragging the deactivated armor he wore with the last of his strength. Just lie there, soldier, she ordered. In the few seconds the field had been down, Lao's tactical display had been updated. A host of friendly troops were converging on the council chamber. Help was only moments away. The man turned to face her. He brought up the Rix blaster, leveled at her chest. At this range, a blast from it would kill everyone inside the field. Executive officer. The stasis field in the council chamber is down again, sir. Good. Contact them, damn it. Hobbs frantically tried to establish a link with Corporal Lau. By the process of elimination, she had determined that Lau was the Marine inside the stasis field. A few seconds before, the shield had dropped, but then had popped up again, and there hadn't been time to connect. Lau, she ordered on the Marine broadband. Do not raise the field again. The situation is secure. The second wave of Marines had secured the council chamber, and a rotary wing medevac unit from the capital's hospital was in position on the palace roof. There was no response from Corporal Lau. Dr. Vetcher! She tried. Neither of the Marines' armor telemetry was active. Even the diagnostic feed from the doctor's medical equipment had disappeared. Sir, she said, turning to face her captain, something's wrong. He didn't answer. With a strange smile of resignation, Captain Zaire leaned back into his bridge chair and nodded his head, murmuring something beneath his breath. It almost sounded like, of course. Then the reports came in from below, fast and furious. The council chamber was secure, but Lau was dead, along with Dr. Vetcher, Initiate Barris, and two hostages, victims of Rix blaster fire. The shield generator had been destroyed. Apparently, a last Rix commando had been alive, having survived the railgun attack and had been inside the stasis field. In those close quarters, a single blaster shot had killed all six of them, even the Rix woman herself. In a few more moments, it was determined who the two hostages were. One was Admiral Fenton Pry, General Staff Officer of the Lesser Spinwood Fleet, holder of the Order of John, the Victory Matrix, and a host of campaign medals from the Corwood Band Succession Moorhead and the Verai Rebellion. The other was Child Empress Anastasia Vista Carmen, sister to His Imperial Majesty, the Risen Emperor. The rescue attempt had failed. Hobbs listened as Captain Zaire recorded a short statement into his log. He must have prepared it earlier, Hobbs realized, to save the lives of his crew. The Marines and naval personnel of the Lynx performed admirably and with great bravery against a perfidious enemy. This mission was carried out with distinction, but its basic plan and direction were flawed. The error of blood is mine and mine alone. Captain Laurent Zai, His Majesty the Emperor's Navy. Then the captain turned and slowly left the bridge under the eyes of his stunned crew, shambling rather than walking as if he were already a dead man. 100 years earlier, Imperial Absolute. House. The house was seated in the range of mountains that almost encircled the planet's great polar tundra. The seed braked its fall with a long, black drogue shoot, made of smart carbon fibers and exotic alloys, rolling to a stop in the soft 5-meter snows that shouldered the chosen peak. At rest and buried in the snow, it lay silent for 3 hours, performing an exacting diagnostic routine before proceeding. It was a complex mechanism, this seed, and an undiscovered flaw now could doom the house to years of nagging problems and petty repairs. It was certainly in no hurry. It had decades in which to grow. At length, the seed determined that it was in fine shape. If there were any problems, they were of the sort that hid themselves. A corrupted diagnostic routine, a faulty internal sensor. But that couldn't be helped. It was one of the natural limits of any self-aware system. In celebration of its good health, the seed took a long drink of the water that its drogue shoot had been collecting. The shoot's dark surface was splayed across the snow, absorbing sunlight and melting a thin layer of snow beneath it. This water was carried to the seed by a slow capillary process, a few centiliters each minute reaching the core. The seed's gut quickly broke the water into hydrogen and oxygen, burning the former for quick energy, saving the latter. It radiated the heat of this combustion back to the drogue shoot. More snow was melted, more water collected, more hydrogen burned. Finally, this cycle of energy production reached a critical point, and the seed was strong enough to make its first visible movements. It tugged at the drogue chute, drawing it inward, and as deliberately as a patient on a carefully measured diet, it consumed the clever and useful materials from which the chute was made. From these, as the heat of its labors caused the seed to sink deeper into the snow, it began to make machines. Cylinders, simple-thinking reeds whose mouths gnawed, whose guts processed and analyzed, whose anuses excreted subtly changed materials, crawled through the mountain peak on which the seed found itself. They mapped its structure and determined that its steep but sound shoulders were as stable as a pyramid and capable of withstanding howling gales, construction tremors, even 10,000-year quakes. The cylinders found veins of useful metals, copper and magnesium, even a few grams of meteoric iron. They sent gravity waves through the peak, scrying its flaws and adjusting them with a compression bomb here, a graviton annealment there. Finally, the seed deemed the building site sound. Carbon whisker butterflies pulled themselves out of the snow. One flew to the summit of the icy peak. Others found crags and promontories that looked out in all directions. Their wings were photosensitive, and the butterflies stood stock still in the light breeze, taking slow, rich exposures of the peak's splendid views. The artificial insects then glided down into the valleys and across to neighboring peaks, photographing sightlines and colored lichens and the delta-shaped flows of meltwater. Sated with these images, the butterflies flew back to the seed, crawling back into the snow. The data coiled in their bellies were unwound and digested, views constructed and cropped with possible windows, sunsets, and seasonal shifts calculated. The happenstance waterfalls of an extrapolated midsummer sculpted and regarded. The butterflies ventured forth every day for weeks, gathering sights and samples and leaving behind survey markers no bigger than grains of rice. And the seed found that its aesthetics concerns were also met. The peak was deemed acceptable in function and in form. The seed called for its second stage and waited. Scattered across likely sites in the great polar range were other seeds, sown at some expense. The devices themselves were costly, as were prospecting options on land ownership even in the cold, empty south of home. But almost all the others had fallen on fallow ground. The seed was one of very few successes. So when the second stage arrived, it was repletely stocked. A large supply of those building materials unavailable on site, detailed plans created by real human architects from the seed's data, and best of all, a splendidly clever new mind to manage the project. This artificial intelligence was capable not only of implementing the architect's plans, but also of improvising its own creative flourishes as the work unfolded. The dim awareness of the seed felt incorporation into this new intelligence as a mighty, expansive rush, like an orphaned beggar suddenly adopted by a wealthy and ancient family. Now work began in earnest. More devices were created. Some of them scurried to complete the imaging of the site. Others began to mine the peak for raw materials and to transmute it to its new shape. Thousands of butterflies were built, swarming the neighboring mountains. Their wings now reflective, they focused the near constant summer sun on the building site, raising its temperature above freezing and providing the laboring drones with solar energy when the last of the snow on the peak was finally melted, its load of hydrogen expended. A latticework began to enclose the peak, long thin tubes sculpted from the mountain's igneous base material. This web of filaments covered the site like a fungal growth and moved material around the peak with the steady pulse of the old seed core, now transformed into a steam turbine. Within this mycoid embrace, the house began to take shape. In the end, there were six balconies. That was one of the few design elements the new mind retained from the original plan. At first, the human architect team approved of the project mind's independence. After all, they had set the mind's operating parameters to highest creativity. They reacted to its changes the way parents will to the improvisations of a precocious child. They applauded the greenhouse on the northern face and complimented the scheme of mirrors that would provide it with sunlight reflected from distant mountains in the wan winter months. They failed to protest the addition of a network of ornamental waterfalls covering the walls of the great cliffs that dominated the house's western view. What finally raised the architect's ire was the fireplace. Such a barbaric addition, so obviously a reference to the surrounding snows, and so useless. Already the house's geothermal shaft extended 7,000 meters into the planet's crust. It was a very warm house when it wanted to be. And the fireplace would require chemical fuel or even real wood imported via suborbital. a gross violation of the original design's self-sustaining aesthetic. These sorts of flourishes had to be stopped.